This is Sally Thinks a Lot.
And this is Cloverleaf, the world's luckiest gamer.
And you're about to listen to Dice Hate Me and Monkey 238 on The State of Games.
Magic Missile!
State of Games sound check. 1, 2.
3, 4.
5, 6.
7, 8.
Your face.
Your face.
Your face.
Your face.
All right, and welcome to the State of Games. I'm Dice Hate Me.
And this is Monkey 238.
And this is episode 3, or as we like to call it, the one about the death and life of Monopoly. We'd like to thank Sally Thanks a Lot and Cloverleaf for the intro this week. And Sally actually planted the seeds for this week's discussion topic at one of our daily lunch games. If any of you are unfamiliar with Sally and Clover, you can learn more about them on DiceHateMe.com along with this podcast, where I'll post a link to the 7 Habits of Highly Dysfunctional Gamers. So anyway, this week we want to talk a bit about today's gamers, and more specifically with modern tweaks to old classics like Monopoly and Battleship, Clue, things like that. Most specifically, and recently on Twitter and in many online forums, have been really all abuzz about Hasbro's latest announcement about Monopoly, which is Monopoly Live. And some of you may have seen some articles. New York Times had an article about it. Monkey and I were talking about that the other day. For those not familiar with Monopoly Live, it's basically a high-tech version of Monopoly. It has this strange obelisk in the middle of the table that has infrared cameras and detectors on it. It looks a little bit like a sausage grinder. But anyway, it monitors everything going on in the game. It rolls the dice for you. It has random events such as horse races that, you know, happen on this. And there's this little, I don't know, a cab. You saw the picture of it, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this little cab that every now and then when you land on one of the tax spaces, you can try to avoid taxes by putting the cab in one place and sliding it along this rail until you get to a specific spot. And if you hit the spot correctly, then you can avoid paying taxes.
Because you're in a taxi.
Of course.
Which makes
no sense.
No sense.
Yeah, I have no idea. I guess you're driving the taxi and your fares offset the taxes or something like that. Or taxi, taxes. You get it?
Yeah.
Somebody.
It's a stretch.
But anyway, one of the things that we were thinking of, you know, I watched a video of it the other day, and everybody that was playing it seemed like they were having a pretty good time. But one thing that I know disturbs at least me about some of the new developments in games is the fact that the games are becoming more and more automated, and they're doing things for the players more and more. And especially, I worry about that with younger players. We grew up playing Monopoly the completely analog way. You had to learn to count your own money, figure out your own property values, try to assess where you were at in the game. And this thing keeps track of your money. The properties are still on the individual cards, but the game announces all the things and all the money is tracked on these little debit cards that are slid in and out of slots. So, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, is your concern about this automated game or just games that have been shortened in general?
Some of it, I think, a little bit is not necessarily shortened games, as long as the classics are still there. And I know Monopoly is a very kind of a divisive subject, especially amongst hardcore board gamers. I mean, there's a whole subset of board gamers who just loathe Monopoly. And I don't personally understand that because, I mean, it's lasted for 75 years for a reason. I don't have a problem with spinning off games off of the Monopoly thing. For instance, you and I really like Monopoly Deal. We're going to talk a little bit about that later on in the State of Games. So I don't think it's my issue of shortening games so much. I fear, though, that with the short attention spans of people, and at least younger children nowadays, that they're going to not have the full attention they'll need to play more advanced things or to learn that patience later in their life.
I'm personally not particularly concerned about any of this because it's not like the newer versions have replaced the older versions into non-existence. It's not like the classics have become extinct or endangered. And I think from a business perspective, yes, society in general has become much more quicker paced, and businesses need to keep up with society's trends, and it's just a matter of survival.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. In order to stay competitive, companies like Hasbro have to introduce new ideas and new twists on old board games. It's one of those old things where, you know, you fear the replacement of something that's classic. But we're going to talk to Kevin Tostado here in a few minutes. And as we learned by watching his documentary, they still use the same classic traditional Monopoly game that was invented in 1935, or at least patented in 1935. So I guess it's not really being replaced. It's being supplanted by these other versions. But when you read the article, the New York Times article, how did you feel about this fully automated thing that's taking over the game?
It wouldn't be my choice to purchase. I mean, if I were to get another version of Monopoly, it would not be that one. But we have purchased two of the spinoffs of Monopoly, Monopoly Deal and Monopoly Express. And there is a time and place for those. I mean, Those are the games that, let's say Monopoly Express, where we'll play when it's kind of late at night and we only have a few minutes. And, you know, that's the game we'll bring out. So it does have a place in our cabinet. And Monopoly Deal has proven to be a hit with our bar friends, our parents, your lunch game group.
Yeah.
There is a place for these. And I don't know, I think it would be a little judgmental to just totally knock down this automated version. It's not my choice and it's not my taste, but I'm assuming there is a place for it. And Hasbro has to do something to keep Monopoly alive. And if that's
viable.
What it takes.
Right. And the thing is we have this niche that we're in now where we play, you know, a lot of Euro games and subset of the hobby, which is longer games, things like that. I don't really have a problem with the shorter spinoffs of things. But I'm torn about this new thing. I'm torn about Monopoly Live because my initial reaction to it was that it was a negative thing, that I didn't like it. And I tried to go back and think about why I didn't like it. And I think that it was because one of the reasons why I love board gaming is the fact that it is an analog pastime. You know, I spend so much time at the computer working every day. Most people do. They spend a lot of time at the computer. And one thing that's great about, you know, playing board games is unplugging and sitting down and having that social aspect. Now, the intrusion of this electronic thing into sort of a traditional board game realm, for some reason, it just had a negative reaction to me. The longer I've thought about it, the more I realize it's more of a knee-jerk reaction on my part. It's simply something that I might try, but I don't think normally that I would want to play. Again, growing up, we had some automated things. I mean, I had Electronic Battleship. Electronic Battleship was the greatest thing ever. We didn't have to go D7. Oh, no, you missed. I mean, you punched in the code, and then you heard the big, you know, it was awesome. But, I mean, if the same thing came out today and all we had was regular Battleship, we'd probably have the same sort of reaction to it that we did with Monopoly Live now.
Do you think you'd feel as negatively if it wasn't Monopoly? What if it just had a whole different name and the whole theme of it was changed but the mechanics were the same? Would the issue be the same? Or is it because it's using the theme and concepts from a 75-year-old classic board game?
I mean, maybe that's possibly it. You know, there's sort of that nostalgia factor, at least in our generation, growing up and playing Monopoly. Whether you like the board game or not, you grew up playing it either with your friends or family. Most everyone has experienced it one time or the other. And when you start messing around with this nostalgic ideal you have for a game, it gets under your skin a little bit. Now, I'm not opposed to sort of these interesting electronic or audio ideas sneaking into games. For instance, Space Alert introduced a CD that counts down and barks out orders while you're playing these characters on a spaceship and trying to keep the spaceship alive from all these threats. It was a really great idea, really well implemented, and definitely not a fully analog experience. I'm not really opposed to those sorts of things. I'm kind of worried about how Monopoly is so ingrained. I would guess probably 80 to 90% of people, if they get introduced to board games at a young age, it's going to be with Monopoly. Because everyone knows the rules, everyone can pick it up and play it immediately. And I fear that some of these more electronic versions are going to supplant the original 1935 version, and everything that we learned kind of playing that game, educational-wise, is kind of being taken away and stripped away by this electronic version.
But isn't it up to the parents and teachers to introduce the original? And that's the generation that is more likely to have that nostalgia and pass that on.
It's true. I mean, there again, that's a very split argument. And again, obviously, we could talk about this all night, and I'm sure that a lot of people have very strong opinions on it. Twitter was just exploding when the news came out, and a lot of people really felt that it was a negative thing. But they hadn't played it yet. Most of the people with the opinions on it hadn't played it yet. And you make a good point that it's, I believe that the original Monopoly will continue to live on in its original form because so many people, you can just pick it up. I mean, the Monopoly Live version costs like $50, $55, when you can go down and go to almost any thrift store or something and pick up a used Monopoly for like $2 to $5 and teach your kids or your friends the same game you grew up with. At any rate, as we said before, we could sit here and talk about this all day, but I'm sure all of you out there have an opinion, so let us know what you think. Email your comments to podcast@dicehateme.com or leave a comment on the State of Games Episode 3 post on dicehateme.com. Speaking of Monopoly, we're lucky to be joined this time on the State of Games by Kevin Tostado, the producer and director of the documentary Under the Boardwalk, The Monopoly Story. Thanks for joining us, Kevin.
Well, thank you.
We just watched the documentary, and actually we really enjoyed it. In fact, in the middle, I turned to Chris and said, this kind of makes me want to play Monopoly. And funny enough, a couple of our friends a couple of weeks ago mentioned that they wanted to play Monopoly, and I kind of let out a bit of a groan. So you're obviously doing something right.
Yeah, we really, really had a good time watching it. It brought up a lot of emotion, actually, which it's kind of mixed with nostalgia a bit, but also the story that you're telling about the championships was, I thought, very compelling. So you just wrapped up the Sedona Film Festival, right?
That's correct. Where we had two great screenings, and we've also just started a release of the film in San Diego on March 4th.
So it went well for you. You got a good reaction?
It did.
Is the goal to show up in other movie theaters across the nation?
In addition to San Diego, we plan to do a release of the film in New York City in May for a week in theaters. And we hope to be able to take it to other cities beyond that. And so one of the things we're doing now is a campaign on Kickstarter.com to help us raise funds for us to be able to take the film to even more cities.
And how's that going so far? Are you close to your goal?
It's been going well, and our campaign ends on March 11th, and we're hoping to hit our goal of $20,580, which is the amount of money that comes in a set of Monopoly. So we're trying to turn our bank of Monopoly money into real money.
That's cool.
Well, there goes our riddle for our podcast this week. No, I'm kidding. So I guess really quickly, I'm assuming you're a Monopoly fan, obviously, if you've put your all into doing this documentary, but why Monopoly? Why did you choose Monopoly to do this?
For me, Monopoly was always my favorite board game growing up as a kid. It was just kind of always there as a childhood staple. And I think as a teenager, I learned that they had U.S. and World Championships, and I got the book, The Monopoly Companion, written by Phil Urbanes, which is kind of an excellent strategy guide that lets you know about all the probabilities and what level of houses to build and which color groups are more valuable at different points in the game. And so I kind of had a dream of maybe competing at the U.S. Championships someday, but because they only held the tournaments every 4 years, I guess I tended to think about it at the wrong times in that cycle. And so back in summer of 2007, I was trying to figure out what to do for my next film, and I decided to do a documentary. And if you're going to spend a couple years or more working on one topic, it should be something that you have somewhat of a passion for. And after doing a lot of self-reflection, realized that Monopoly was something that had always had a big place in my heart, and knew that the 75th anniversary of the game was going to be coming up soon, as well as the next round of the tournaments. So I figured it's the perfect time to make a film about Monopoly.
Yeah, that sounds like serendipity.
So do you think you'll enter in the future?
Since we've finished filming, I've begun competing in a couple different local tournaments, and I've finished in the top 10 in both of those. And I do plan to continue playing some tournaments and practicing so that hopefully in 2013, which is when they're expecting to do the next one, that I will do my best to try and qualify.
Awesome. Where's that supposed to be located?
They change the location every time just to kind of mix it up. This most recent time was in Washington, D.C., but the time before that they held it on a train that actually traveled from Union Station in Chicago all the way to D.C., and then they played the final game in Atlantic City, New Jersey. So they've kind of held them all over the country, and the World Championships are in a different city every time around the world.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. When we're watching a documentary, it looks like everybody's having a good time there, but it also looks like a lot of pressure.
Yeah, it certainly is. For Ken Curry, who's in the film, when he was at the 2003 U.S. Championship, he was very sick and decided to try and play through it, and kind of, I guess a part of it was also stress-related. He was just so kind of overwhelmed and just hoping to do well that he was, like, physically sick before the match, and they almost disqualified him because he wasn't going to be able to make the table in time, but he pulled through, and he ended up coming up third in the nation back in 2003, and then was back in 2009 to compete again, and you'll see how he does in the film.
And also in the film, speaking of King Khoury, there's a part where they're all trying to qualify for the U.S. championships online on Pogo, and he accused Tim Vandenberg of cheating when he called he outed an anonymous player on there. I hope I'm not making any spoilers for people who want to see the documentary, but did other gamers consider Tim a cheater as well, or was that just mostly kind of Ken just kind of throwing some smoke in Tim's face?
I think it was pretty much just Ken that had beef with Tim. Even Gary, the player who was impacted by Tim in that online qualifying, they resolved it between the two of them very quickly, and Ken kind of held on to that for a while, and still not entirely sure why. But that's the type of person that Ken is. He's very litigious, and filed a number of complaints and protests regarding the qualifying process.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story about all these guys and how they go through the U.S. championships, and we're not going to give away, you know. Of course, people can go online and find out who won, but I hope they don't. I hope they just wait all the way through, because we weren't sure ourselves, but it was interesting seeing how it all played out.
I think one of our favorite parts of the documentary was the history of the 30-year evolution of the game as it traveled from Arden to Philadelphia and into the hands of Charles Darrow, who many think invented the game. That was a really, really cool segment. Did you know most of this information before you did the documentary, or did that take further research on your part?
Phil Robbins, who's kind of the chief historian for Monopoly and also serves as the chief judge at all of the tournaments for the U.S. World Championships, has spent most of the last 20 years on his side, on the side, kind of researching the history, and while some of the kind of the key people with Parker Brothers were still alive, he did interviews and kind of looked into the research. And so he served as kind of an advisor for the film and helped us to make sure that our history was accurate and had kind of already laid the groundwork in regards to a lot of that research. And also back in the 70s, I believe, there was a court case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court regarding the Monopoly trademark when a professor decided to create a game called Anti-Monopoly. And he was sued over the use of the Monopoly trademark as part of the game. And during this discovery process, they were able to find out a lot of that early history. And that was kind of the first time that much of it was brought to light.
It was a really cool way, with all the animation and things and showing, you know, from the map how it traveled around. And it was like 27 miles between Arden and Philadelphia, but it traveled almost around half the country to get back around. I think people are really going to get a lot out of that part of the documentary. Mm-hmm. One other thing that we were kind of new to when we watched the documentary is that they introduced the speed die in the tournaments, and we'd never even seen the speed die. I guess we're behind on our Monopoly technology because, you know, we still play the old traditional game. But it was really interesting to see the players' reaction to the speed die because they're so used to, the odds really being there. And we won't say who won. We're going to leave that up so people can watch. But, again, the winner of the U.S. tournament, do you think that some of the competitors thought he might have won simply because of luck of the dice? Or did you hear any of that whatsoever?
I think certainly the speed die, which was kind of an accessory that they added to the game in 2008 when they kind of updated the graphics a little bit and kind of standardized it. Most of the players kind of felt that it really did introduce a lot more luck into the game. And so the people who you might have expected to be the typical final four players, that kind of went out the window a little bit because of that extra element of chance that was introduced for the U.S. championship. Rick was somewhat of an unknown and really had no prior tournament experience to the U.S. championship. So the fact that he made the final four in the beginning, as well as Brandon Baker, another novice player essentially, it just shows that the speed die definitely put some more luck into the game.
Right, so it's sort of like the NFL trying to introduce parity, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit more excitement to the tournaments.
Mm-hmm. And for their purposes, Hasbro wanted to introduce the speed die to help the games play quicker, and with the speed die, it certainly did play quicker. They usually had seven different tables going at simultaneously, and most of them were finishing the games in about 60 to 70 minutes. And without the speed die, you would normally expect a game to take a little bit longer, about 90 minutes, if you're playing by all the rules.
Now, do you know if the speed die was introduced for tournament purposes, or was it for the mass consumer market?
It was. It had been out for maybe a couple months, but prior to the U.S. championship, it really hadn't been publicized much, and so Hasbro saw the U.S. and World Championships as an opportunity to get word out about this new dice at the championships. And it led them to be able to, in the World Championship at least, be able to proclaim that it was the fastest World Championship final game ever, because it only took about 41 and a half minutes or so. And just them being able to use the statistics about playing faster certainly might lead consumers to believe that the game doesn't take as long as they might have expected.
Right. And one part of the documentary that we were listening and really called out to us was when they were discussing how there's so many house rules has been introduced to Monopoly over the years, and if you know, you're playing the real rules of Monopoly, it doesn't take 18 days to play it. You know, it's you can actually get through a game in a night. And I think I'd like to do an informal poll sometime to find out how many different people actually use the different house rules that extend the life of the game. It's just one of those interesting cultural phenomenon that surrounds the game itself. And I guess, I mean, with 75 years of history, there's so much input that people like to do and with their families and kind of the oral history of the game too. So,
And I think in addition to the house rules, you could almost look at the lack of playing with all of the rules also being house rule, because very few people have actually ever read the rules of Monopoly for themselves. Many people were taught by their friends or by their parents. And as such, very few people know about the rules. Like if you land on a property and you don't buy it for whatever reason, either you don't can't afford it or you don't want it, it immediately then goes up for auction, and then all players can bid on it starting at $1. So say you want to buy Boardwalk and it's normally $400, but you know your opponents are cash poor, you can put it up for auction and try and get it for maybe $100 because you know your opponents can't bid anything higher than that.
Yeah, and matter of fact, it was funny because Monkey just yesterday when we started watching the documentary, she brought that up. She's like, did you know? And she said that rule, and I was like, I knew that rule from being a kid, but we almost never as a family played that way. But I think it's a fascinating rule, and it's interesting that what you say, that a lot of people, it's more of an oral rule set than people just sitting down and reading the rules of Monopoly for the first time. And I think that actually speaks a bit to the history of the game as well and how it evolved over those 30 years before Darrow took it to Parker Brothers and they produced the official version of Monopoly.
It's almost a social phenomenon, you know, that it's evolved this way.
Yeah.
Do you know if the rules have changed at all throughout the years, or is it the same set that came with the very first Parker Brothers edition?
The majority of the rules have stayed the same over the years. When Darrow first began publishing Monopoly in 1934, the sets did not come with tokens, so that was not an official part of the rules. And there's been some other clarifications over time that they've added just to help kind of streamline the gameplay a little bit, but the basic elements of the gameplay mechanisms have remained the same.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And it's amazing it's had the longevity that it has. Well, we just want to ask you really quickly. We were talking about it yesterday, and we thought what a cool part of the documentary is you ask everybody what their favorite token is. So What is your favorite token?
Well, my token kind of changes. I actually use it as a strategy that I don't get too attached to one token because if other people have strong leanings towards one, I'll try and see if maybe I can use that against them in some way. But generally, if I had a pick first, I'll usually end up going with the iron.
Interesting. Nice.
Is there any particular reason? Is there a story behind that?
Much like one of the players in the film says, it's great in that it's small and you can easily hide it behind a hotel, so perhaps you can avoid a big rent while your opponent doesn't notice it.
So, remaining innocuous. I gotcha. Yeah, we were also talking during it, and there are, of course, the orange and red properties, which everyone, at least who plays the game a lot, knows. Those are the key properties for gaining the most income because that's the one that people land on the most. But we all seem to have our favorite set of properties that we still have an emotional attachment to for one reason or another, and we always want to get. Do you have a set of those?
I think I've known long enough that the oranges were kind of the magic set within the game of Monopoly. So for me, they've kind of always been my favorite set and the ones that I'll always try and acquire if I can. However, I'm not going to give up so much cash or other properties to get it that I then have no chance of winning the game.
I think that's one of the fun parts of the game, too, is a little bit of the emotional and nostalgia factor. And like you mentioned, you can sometimes use that to your advantage. You know, if you've got a piece of property that you know somebody just loves, you can sometimes eke a little bit more money out of them, and I think that's kind of a fun aspect of the game.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the amazing things about Monopoly is how it's become such a pop culture reference, along with just products like mugs, I don't know, t-shirts, socks, whatever it may be. Also, the many derivatives of the game that has been produced. We actually own two, and those are the two that we play more than the classic game. We play Monopoly Express and Monopoly Deal.
Right.
And
right.
I think we particularly like Monopoly Deal.
Yeah, Monopoly Deal is a really great product, and I think it plays off of that nostalgia factor. It still has the properties out there, and people still want to try to, you know, get them and play the special cards to get them, and it's really been an amazing branding.
Plus, you can still backstab a little bit in
version.
That deal breaker card is rather brutal.
Yes.
yeah, it is. Every time you break it out, you're just like, "Urgh!" So, but go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask if you have played most of them and if you like them or not, or if you're just a purist.
I try and play all the different Monopoly versions that have come out. I've tried the Monopoly Revolution, which was the one that was introduced last fall, where it's got the round board, but it also uses the electronic banking where you use a cash card instead of actual cash. And it's interesting. They claim that using a cash card makes it so it's impossible to cheat because then there's no money to steal from the bank. But it's just as easy to add an extra zero when you're paying yourself on the end of an amount of money.
Well, speaking of that, and one thing that we're discussing on the podcast is the new Monopoly Live. We've mentioned that it pretty much does almost everything in the game. It counts the money for you. It has sensors, so it makes sure that you're not cheating, rolls the die for you, things like that. There's been a little bit of backlash in the board gaming community because a lot of people are reporting that it just takes all of the input away from the game, so it's removing a lot of the elements or the classic elements that everyone has grown up with. But we just want to get your take on that. Do you think that it'll bring in new fans?
I think that the reason that they're introducing things like Monopoly Live, and they're also doing a Battleship Live as well that also uses that infrared technology. And I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to reach out to kind of the younger generation who have grown up with video games being a part of their life and who maybe think of board games as being something that's slow and not as entertaining. And so I think they're trying to create a new version of the game that kind of tries to take some of the best of both and the interactivity of video games and using your hands to manipulate, much like you do now with the Wii and with Kinect and PlayStation Move, and trying to incorporate some of those ideas into a board game while still also getting the classic brands out there. And they're not replacing the original Number 9, the game that everyone grew up with. That's still going to continue to be sold. And I think versions like Revolution and Live are just a way of trying to get people who may not have known about the brand or may not have been playing the brand in a while to experience a new way of trying to play it.
The Number 9, what's the significance of that? I'm not sure about the history behind that.
When they release product numbers, like if you look on the side of any Parker Brothers or Hasbro product, it has a kind of a little product code. And some of the early Monopoly sets were like 008 or 005, 035. So if you looked at some of the artwork, it would say the number 8 or the number 9 or the deluxe number 35 or something like that. And so the one that was the very basic version was the number 9. And throughout its 75 years, it has always remained the product code number 9. And so that's why some people refer to it that way, because even though the exterior of the box has changed over time, it's still the same product, so they still refer to it as the number 9.
That's cool. Yeah, I never knew that before. I'm still fascinated by the history of Monopoly itself.
I really liked your outtake at the end of the documentary with the final game being played on that giant board in San Jose. Did you actually gather all those players together solely for the documentary, or how did that all come about?
Yeah, so we brought kind of four of our main characters, Tim, Matt, Dom, and Ken, together to the world's largest permanent outdoor Monopoly game board. It's called Monopoly in the Park in San Jose, California. It measures 31 by 31 feet. So we just thought it would be a fun visual for our audience to get to see these people who are so used to playing around a table to have to try and implement their strategies where they're standing 30 feet away from each other and kind of yelling to each other, "I'll trade you Kentucky for Illinois," or just going on and on, and having to throw the dice, which are bigger than their head. And they were definitely tired after 2 hours of playing.
I don't doubt it. We loved watching them run around and have those giant hats on. They got helmets and with the tokens on top of their heads. I mean, it's really great to end the documentary with that and see that. As a matter of fact, I'd like to even see even more outtakes, like, and to hear them. You know, do you have any sort of, like, quote-unquote director's cut, or are there little snippets online anywhere people can find?
We are working on putting together some special features for the special edition DVD, which we hope to release this summer, as well as to get it onto iTunes and Netflix. As I mentioned earlier in this podcast, we are trying to take the film to a few more cities to play theatrically. But if you're interested in finding out more about the film, you can certainly do so at our website, which is monopolydocumentary.com, or on Facebook at facebook.com/underTheBoardwalk.
Great. We really appreciate you being on the podcast this week, and we hope that people will check it out. We really enjoyed it. We, again, like I said, Monkey just all of a sudden was like, you know, it kind of makes me want to play Monopoly, so definitely you're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
So we really appreciate you you talking to us, and we wish you all the luck, and hopefully our listeners will go and check out your Kickstarter campaign and your documentary itself and can catch it when it's in the theaters.
Well, thank you guys very much for having me on and taking the time to watch the film.
Yeah,
yep.
Awesome.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks. All right, well, we'd like to thank Kevin for taking time out to speak to us about the documentary. Again, there are only a few days left in the Kickstarter campaign. There's a lot of money left to raise so that we can see this documentary be shown in more theaters and more screens. So please go to Kickstarter.com and search for Under the Boardwalk. There will also be a link to the Kickstarter campaign website on DiceHateMe.com, as well as a link to the Under the Boardwalk official site so you can learn more about the documentary. One thing that we didn't really talk about, because we didn't want to keep Kevin on the phone forever, but we were talking the other day. I wanted to know, Monkey, what exactly is your favorite token and property?
I remember growing up that I liked the shoe. I don't know why. And I actually had to text my mom to...
You liked what? What did you like?
The shoe.
The shoe?
The shoe.
The shoe? That's your Brooklyn coming out.
The shoe. And I actually had to text my mom to see if I was correct or if I created that memory. But she actually wrote back, she couldn't remember, but she thought it was either the shoe or the Scotty. So I guess I didn't make it up.
It's probably not shocking that it was the Scotty, because he doesn't really have a tail.
Oh, that's true. I hate tails, by the way.
Yeah, she has a problem with dogs' tails.
Wag. That,
yeah. We haven't been able to quite get down to the childhood trauma that involves, but...
And as far as property set, I always liked green and orange, but I have a feeling as strategic as that I know that that is now, as far as the orange properties, I think I just chose them because I like those colors.
Yeah, you were probably very partial to green and oranges.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I always liked, well, I like the battleship now, but we didn't have the battleship in the set when I was growing up. I mean, the battleship is awesome. My dad was always the horse and rider, which in current, or at least the current edition we saw, doesn't really have the horse and rider anymore, which is a shame because I always liked it too. When my dad didn't play it, I'd always take it and play with the horse and rider. Most of the time after that, I would take the race car, which is not surprising.
Yeah.
I guess my favorite set of properties were probably the green, but it was, I think that's also the properties that have North Carolina Avenue on it, and growing up in North Carolina, I always wanted to make sure they had North Carolina Avenue.
Oh, I didn't think about that. Maybe that's why I chose orange, because of New York.
Yeah, that's true.
That's
might possible.
Be a reason.
Yeah, I think one of my other favorite property, and one that hardly anybody ever takes, is I like the Roach Motels. The Baltic and Mediterranean at the very beginning of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I always like to buy those because I can immediately put houses and build them up to hotels. And a lot of people kind of diss them, and the statistics show that they're not really that great to take. But I liked them.
That's cool.
All right, so moving on. Let's get down to the state of games. If any of you are experiencing nostalgia for old classics like Monopoly, Clue, or Trivial Pursuit, but you hate the idea that they might take hours to play, or they might end up boring, or you don't want to ruin your nostalgia factor for them, Monkey and I have some suggestions. This is something she hasn't had much experience with yet, but I want to break out and play with her soon, and that's the Board Game Remix Kit. Well, this PDF you can download. You can also buy the book. It's sold at boardgame-remix-kit.com, and I'll put that link on the DiceHateMe.com website along with this podcast. But anyway, what it does is it's very well laid out. It's a great designed product. But it has some new rules for old classics, like Clue, Scrabble, Monopoly. It has variations and tweaks, but also can make completely new games out of things. For instance, in Clue, there's a variant that has all the players that are trapped inside the Clue mansion while zombies are attacking.
Well, that's different.
Yeah, definitely. So it's really pretty cool. Anyway, you can buy the PDF for only £3. Again, I'm saying pounds because it's made and sold by the Brits. So you'll have to pay the conversion fee. You can buy the real book for about £8, but they also sell on the site custom-made cards that go along with the games themselves, and again, these are really fantastically designed products. Anyway, since the book's from the Brits, there are a couple instances where you'll need a British to American board game translation device, otherwise known as the Internet. So, for instance, in the British version of Monopoly, all the properties have different names, so Mayfair is Boardwalk, Park Lane is Park Place, so on and so forth. To learn more about that, again, I'll have the link to that on my website, and that's something I want to break out with Monkey soon and kind of dust off some of those old classics, especially since Monkey, is every time she hears the word Monopoly, wants to run from the room. Since we're in the middle of the State of the Games and Monopoly is our main topic this week, we mentioned it earlier when we were talking a bit about short attention spans, but one of the spinoffs of Monopoly is Monopoly Deal, and we really love Monopoly Deal. Mm-hmm. It's a great game. Friends seem to love it. We take it to the bar. We play a lot of different times. And we got it. Did we pick it up when we went on our vacation last year in the mountains?
Yes. I saw it at the bookstore we were at.
Yeah. And I was a little, I don't know, I was...
Yeah, you were hesitant, but I was really excited.
This is before I really got her into super geeky games. The same trip was when we bought Roll Through the Ages. And we ended up playing Monopoly Deal a ton, and finally I got her to reluctantly play Roll Through the Ages, and she loved that as well. But Monopoly Deal is a great little card game. We're not going to go too much into it right now because there's a full review of it on DiceHateMe.com. It also includes a graphic that I'm actually very proud of that shows how Monopoly Deal stacks up to actual Monopoly, including the part in the old classic where you just want to end it before you poke your eyes out with sharp sticks. But anyway, I'll include a link to that with the podcast itself, and you'll be able to check that out and really pick up Monopoly Deal. It's very cheap. It's a great bang for your buck. You can take it anywhere you go, and I guarantee you that most anybody you introduce to it is going to love it and be able to pick it up quickly because it uses a lot of the same elements that regular Monopoly does.
Another game we want to talk about that was introduced since the last podcast to us is Word on the Street, which I picked up, again, at a bookstore, shockingly, so...
Yeah,
yes,
we play.
Hang out in bookstores
and coffee shops.
And coffee shops. For those of you who don't know, I'm kind of a word nerd, and so is Chris. But there are a few of you out there who play Words with Friends and Word Feud with me that have probably discovered that.
Yeah, there's always every now and then. I don't know how they're doing in their games, but I see a Twitter feed from one of the two guys that play with her online, Ian Noble and Geek Insight, and they're just like crying for mercy all the time. And I'm just laughing because I play her all the time in these word games. But thankfully, sometimes I can hold my own. But
yeah, and you're good too, and so are they. But I just have some knack, I guess. But anyway, so I really love this game. I'm pretty sure Chris does too. I haven't made him run away from it yet.
Because I do love it,
statistics
yeah.
So far have shown me more victorious just for random reasons. But the object of the game is to capture 8 letter tiles by choosing words based on clues that you're given that contain the letters so that you can pull them off the board. And the board looks like a street, and down the center are the letters of the alphabet minus the vowels and the J, Q, X, and Z. The rulebook says that that's supposed to shorten playing time.
We haven't noticed that. A lot of J words and things, yeah.
Yeah, we kind of wish that they were back in there. Anyways, and then on each side of the center row of letters, there are 2 lanes, each representing the player or team. This can be played as a 2-player game, or you can just get together in teams and play like that. And so your goal is to move the letters to your side of the board and get them off the board, and whoever gets 8 first wins. And it's seemingly simple, but every once in a while, and there's a timer.
Yeah.
The hourglass timer, which is not an hour, and it is
it's
not
very
even
fast.
It's not even a minute. Or if it is, it's the quickest minute I've ever experienced, but we should actually see how long that is.
Yeah, we should test it out. I think it's like it's probably 30 seconds. I know it doesn't feel like 30 seconds, but I think it's a 30-second timer. We started playing the game without the timer at first, and because we thought, oh, well, it's probably like a minute or something, and we'll be done thinking about it in a minute. And we were just kind of lazy about it, and we'd say, oh, you're taking a little too long, and we'd you know, finally think of a word really quickly. Well, then we started playing with a timer, and let me tell you.
That just adds a whole nother element, so yeah. Play with the timer. You don't hear it ticking, but it's in your mind, and
oh, you see it in the corner. Yeah, you see it in the corner of your eye, or you're staring at the entire time while you're staring at this board, and you can see those sands running out. And when you get down to that last bit of sand, even a word you've had in your mind that you want to come back to, it'll go right out of your head. Yeah. You'll forget it. And you'll be like, oh, peanut butter. And then you realize it's two words. By the way, you can only do one word.
Or hyphenated.
Or hyphenated.
Yeah. And or all of a sudden you can't remember, you know, the definition of a city or a country.
Yes, yes. She likes to tease me about that one. What was it?
That Vienna is not a country in Europe. Just in case any of you guys didn't know that.
It should be. It should be like Vatican City, its own principality.
We haven't really done a study of it, but it's interesting because you would think that a lot of the common letters would get off the board fairly quickly, but it's been a good mix of the common letters. Let's say the last fight, the last tile that we fight for. Often the K is still on the board.
Oh, yeah, quite often. B and K a lot of times.
Yeah. And then one of the common letters tends to stay on there, like the N or the T, but I think because there's a constant tug of war throughout the game that makes it go on either side of the street.
The components that come with the game are great. The shining star of the game really are the tiles.
Yeah, they're cool. They're heavy.
They are heavy. I mean, you could wing it and take somebody out with one of these things. They are...
Ooh, good idea.
No. We don't want to play where we're going to wing in tiles at each other. Yeah, don't play with someone who might be prone to throw if they don't like the game, because he or she could really hurt someone when they're playing this game. But again, a fantastic game. We love it for... Oh, look at that. In the rules, 30 seconds.
The timer's 30 seconds. I just picked up the rule book, and there it is.
One thing that we didn't mention actually were the clue cards, and in the box there are, how many clue cards are included in the box?
216, which makes 432 categories, because they're double-sided.
Right, and the two sides have different colors. One's a green side, one's a blue side. Supposedly the green side is more simple, or I guess the only difference we've seen, we found sometimes that the blue sides have much more of a wide open possibility, but they require more of an educated knowledge level, more of a worldly knowledge level. Again, you have to know the difference between a city and a country.
You need to know your European geography.
Right, yes. For that, it gives you a lot of variety. You can set it up different ways. And again, fantastic two-player game. We highly recommend it. We really are looking forward to doing team play with this.
Yeah, probably. I think the parents, both sets of parents, are going to experience this
very soon
as a team game.
Absolutely.
So that should be interesting.
And none of them like to throw tiles, so that's good.
At least not that we know of. My mom might.
Yes, if anyone was likely to swing a tile at somebody, it'd be your mom.
She might try and flick one.
But I don't think she'd do it out of anger. She'd just do it to be funny.
Spite.
Yeah, spite or funny. Yeah, exactly. And now it's time for the Riddle of the Sphinx.
Since Monopoly is the topic du jour, this week's riddle is... What properties in the current U.S. edition are different colors than in the original 1935 edition of the game? Send your answer to podcast@dicehateme.com. The first correct answer gets a custom shout-out in next week's podcast. Just give us your manifesto and we'll broadcast it. A lot of you came up with the answer to last week's riddle pretty quickly, but none quicker than Wolfie, this week's winner. He earns a shout-out to his gaming blog, I Slay the Dragon, which is at islaythedragon.com, on which he writes about board games and sometimes about other things. You can also find him on Twitter at FutureWolfie. By the way, the correct answer to last week's Riddle of the Sphinx, in which we asked all of you to figure out how many victory points could be bought with a particular single hand of Dominion, was 7. We'd like to thank all of you who emailed us your incorrect responses. We appreciate your effort.
If you like what we have to say and you want even more, you can always find us on Twitter. Follow me at DiceHateMe.
And find me at Monkey238. Drop me a line and we can discuss Scrabble words that will decimate your opponent.
And don't forget to check out DiceHateMe.com for cool gaming reviews, news, and random geeky views. Until next time, this is DiceHateMe.
And Monkey238.
Saying thanks for listening. And may all your rolls be sixes.